So hello and welcome to another Loose Heads podcast in association with Talking Rugby Union. I'm your host, Chris Heal, for this one, and I'm joined by two of the Loose Heads co-founders this afternoon, Rob Shotton and Mark Shotton, for our next instalment of the pod. Guys, how are we doing today?
Very well, thanks, Chris.
Yeah, good, thanks.
Excellent, excellent. Our latest podcast is out there at the moment with DTH Van der Merwe. It's quality to chat to DTH about his affiliation with the Loose Heads Foundation. And of course, his playing career. And DTH did play in four World Cups for Canada. And our next guest can also boast a decent record when it comes to World Cups. He's played in three of them, and we're delighted to say all the way from Namibia, it is Jack Berger who joins us on the line today. Jack, thank you so much for taking the time out to speak to us. How's life over there at the moment for you?
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure. Yeah, it's going well, thank you. It's Corona time, so things are a bit strange in the world at the moment everywhere. But yeah, it's going really well. Can't complain. Thanks.
Excellent. And Evan Ryan saying, Jack, as well, it's been about nearly 4 years or around about 4 years since you hung up the boots. And I mean, for you, how has life been over that 4 year period? Because I know you've mentioned it in previous interviews, how much, you know, your life changed from one minute you were playing rugby and then you're back on the plane and you're now on the form. So how's the last four years or so been for you?
Yeah, it's been tough. You know, it's been tough adapting to normal life, as people call it. But there's been some good things as well. I think the positives about it is that, I've found a lot of time now to spend with my family, with my kids. Which is when you're in rugby and you're focusing on your goals and you chasing your career, sometimes you forget to pay attention to the things that's really important in life. And over these last four years, I've had the opportunity to do that. But it's been really tough. I'm not gonna lie. I think most rugby players retiring, doesn't matter what you do, it is tough to adapt and to move on to something else. For me, like I said previously, for me, rugby was a dream job. You know, it's something I always wanted to do. And not a lot of people get to do their dream jobs. And to walk away from that and to start something new was quite strange. And then I realized if you can put that same passion that you put into your sport and your rugby and your something that you loved previously or you still love but you're not involved anymore, then if you can put that same passion and drive into your next chapter, then things will go well. And it's been business-wise, we've gone through, I think, one of the toughest droughts in the history of Namibia. So it was not the ideal time to step into farming. But I mean, I've learned a lot of lessons again. That's just the way of life, isn't it? Really, you start something and you have to be knocked down a couple of times before you get stronger and move forward.
Yeah, and I mean, just looking at sort of your Instagrams and Twitter as well, Jack, it looks like an unbelievable setting where you and the family are living at the moment. Just give us, the listeners, an idea of what it's like for you guys.
Yeah, it's the way of life is really nice. You know, I think everybody's complaining about the corona now, but we've actually been self-isolating for 4 years now, so we're not really close to anybody. So we've been staying away from people just in case something like this comes along, and luckily we've stayed out of harm's way for so long. But yeah, it's wide open spaces, it's sunny days every day. You know, it's a lot of time with your family. You know, that's the thing. Sometimes I wonder. I sit back and I wonder why did I come back to doing this and being out here on the farm, being pretty isolated. And then I see the things around me again. Family is the main drive for me now. And then to see what the life my kids are living, you know, the wide open spaces and running around outside. And that's what I wanted. That's what I wanted to give them. I love my time in the UK and I loved living there. And I could always see myself living there again. But it's just a completely different world being out here. The red Kalahari dunes, out in the wildlife. It's amazing.
Yeah, and you speak so well about spending time with your family there, Jack. But I guess when you first decided to make the move, was that quite a tough period for you in terms of that transition?
Yeah, that first year is really exciting. You're back and you're seeing all your friends you've not seen for 10 years, you know, and it's you're spending a lot of time with your parents, and there's a lot of things that you you haven't done in a long time. You go out fishing, just things that you haven't done in a long, long time. And then when that kind of honeymoon period runs out, then it's tough, you know, it's tough. Then we had to build a house from scratch, so that took a long time, and to move into our own house. So for the first couple of years, I had to stay with my in-laws just to wait for the house to finish. And they're great people, but I mean, 2 years is a long time for anybody to live with their in-laws. So my house is all set up now, and then I'm very comfortable now. So it's been a tough transition, but I think for anybody, I'm not going to say I'm special in any way. That's how you start. That's how you get into things. It has to be, it can't just be straightforward. You know, I've realized that in life.
Yeah, we talk to a lot of people that come on the podcast, Jack. We talk about sort of that transition from playing to retirement. And one of the other topics we talk about is injuries as well. And I know you've probably been asked millions and millions of questions about sort of the injuries you picked up on your career. And we all know kind of the physical impact they can have. And the Looseheads Foundation is there to sort of raise awareness for mental health. So how tough is it mentally for going through those injuries as a player as well?
It's extremely tough, you know. I think a lot of people see the rugby player or a sportsman, they see the big stadiums, the big matches, and the incredible trips you go on and the places you see. But injuries make it a very dark place, you know. For me personally, I've had so many, and years. Sometimes some of them I was out for years. Where you're just out on your own doing rehab, you're not getting better, then you get slightly better, then it's worse. It's just an emotional roller coaster, really, and it has a massive effect on your life and your mental well-being. For me as well, it was, like I said, I mean, I loved playing rugby. I loved being out there, and once that was taken away from me and I didn't know if I'll be able to go back, there was really, really dark days that I had to dig deep, you know, days where didn't see the point anymore, but I just kept going forward and trying to get back on the field. And I mean, those are not the days that I want to remember. But it's again days that make you stronger. And when you do get out there and you start playing again, then you appreciate it so much more.
You had a reputation playing rugby, Jack, of being probably the hardest hitter, the hardest tackler there was. I was watching a few YouTube clips at the weekend, and I'd like to think I always knew the sort of people I was tackling, but you took out Backes Botha in a European Cup game, and I'm thinking, bloody hell, that's going to end in tears. But you sport one of the great rugby noses. Just how many times have you broken that nose?
I don't know. A couple of times. What is it? How does it look like from the side? Can you see a side view?
Brilliant.
Looks good.
Love it.
No, I don't know. I think, I mean, it's countless times. Especially early on in my career, my technique wasn't great, and just going face first. And later on in my career as well, I think when you go out and you're trying to make a big hit, sometimes there's not enough time to get the face out of the way. So I'm just going to crack on forward. But yeah, countless amount of times. And it's, gives me character, I suppose.
And just on the injury still, Jack, obviously we talked at the start there that you did sort of retire 4 years ago. Do you look back now and say that was absolutely the right time for you to kind of leave the playing the game behind because of sort of the injuries and sort of that, as you say, the mental well-being aspect of it that you talked about before?
Yeah, I think I should have stopped maybe a year earlier, to be honest. I stuck around and I wanted to play more, but I was not the player that I used to be. That was the main frustrating thing for me, is I couldn't do things that I normally did. I had to completely change the way I was running, and I was getting up from the ground and turning. My knee was just in bits, you know. I just had to adapt. You know, it was kind of a miracle just getting back and playing those 3 years. And I was so blessed. But, I mean, in the morning of a game, I would walk down the stairs and I wouldn't be able to walk down the stairs. And I thought to myself, how am I going to get through this day? And then for 3 years, I could do that. You know, but what took its toll is towards the end, that last year, I wasn't the player that I was anymore. My shoulder was banged up. I couldn't wrap my arms in tackles. I was making poor decisions defensively. And yeah, I was, it was just frustrating because I was, while the other guys were out training on the pitch, I was in the gym cycling or doing rehab. And then I would be out in captain's run and play on the weekend. So I missed that whole camaraderie, the friendships of training in the week and fun and jokes. So it became work. It became all work, just getting, smashing yourself on the weekends, which was great. I loved it. But I mean, you miss that middle week part where you kind of just bond with the boys and you hang out with them and all that. So the frustrating thing for me was towards the end, when I, like I said, when I couldn't do what I wanted to do or be who I wanted to be on a rugby pitch. And I was getting poorer, I was getting weaker, and I was just not improving as a rugby player.
So just sort of on what you said there about sort of, you know, being in the gym while the team are training, just before we get on to sort of your early stage of the career, you've said in the past that, you know, you saw the team and they were constantly improving and Sarries were obviously going from strength to strength. So that was that quite hard for you to see as well, that the team was so improving that you couldn't hit the levels that you really wanted to?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think, like I said, the last year especially, guys were improving, they were getting better. The other back rows deserve to play, you know. And when you're not getting picked or you're getting rotated more often than you want to be and you know you're not playing well, then you get frustrated, you know. Then you start asking questions and you speak to coaches. But in your head, you know why it is. You know you're not playing as well as you should be or doing the things that you should. And for me, the frustrating thing is I wanted to do it. You know, I wanted to do it, but I just physically wasn't able to anymore. I was just a broken man by the end of it. So that was too frustrating for me. I didn't like that feeling at all of walking off a pitch and knowing there was a couple of times where I could have done this, but I just didn't. So I didn't like that feeling.
Yeah. And it seems like you've been sort of not, well, maybe the underdog, Jack, throughout your career in terms of wanting to reach the levels that you said there. And I know right at the start of the career, you learned quite a lot from, I think you mentioned before about maybe balancing your work with playing rugby. I mean, how do you look back on that time when you started playing rugby, where it was, you said yourself, it was quite a tough period for you to actually enjoy playing rugby at that time?
Yeah, it's really tough, you know. For me, I started working after school, you know, didn't get a bursary, didn't go for study, didn't have a contract somewhere. So I was playing rugby part-time and I was working, you know, and I couldn't wait to finish work in the afternoon and get to the rugby pitch as quickly as I can. You know, it was my dream, you know, and I've been told a couple of times in my life that rugby would never work out for me. And if I probably carried on the way I did carry on throughout my high school career or my school career, where I just didn't really care about anything else and I was a bit of a rebel in a way, just went against the grain for many reasons. But I found rugby and when it started becoming my job and I knew I could make a living out of it, I was away. I was happy. I could do what I loved doing. And I appreciate it. Again, you appreciate it a lot more because I was working full time. I didn't really enjoy it, but I did it because I had to do it. And I was up in the mornings, 5 o'clock or 4 o'clock, sometimes before work, and you train hard. You go for a shower, you work from 8 till 5, and then you go back training again. Sometimes you get back 9, 10 in the evening, you get back home. But I was a young man, and there wasn't a lot of complaints that time. I wasn't getting paid at that time either, so it was really just for the love of the game. But it makes you a better rugby player, I think. You know, if you get it from straight out of school, 18, 19, walk into a professional setup, you haven't really had any hiccups. You haven't really... Yes, you fought to get where you are. You're extremely talented, probably. But I feel the best route for me is going through the steps, you know. I think a great example of somebody who just kind of climbed that steps is a guy like Maurits Botha. If you look at his rugby career, where he started and where he ended up playing for England, you know, that's an incredible career. And I like those stories, the guys who go through and they have to fight to get somewhere. They don't play in the most glamorous places early on in their career, but they end up and they make a success from it. So that's, I think that was a thing that's very satisfying for me.
You say there that, Jack, it was your sort of dream to play rugby. So how tough was it for your young man when people said maybe rugby isn't for you?
Yeah, it's tough. It is tough, you know, but it kind of just fuels a fire, doesn't it? I knew that I had something in me. From a young age, I was, I just loved the confrontational part of rugby, getting stuck in, and it's just, there's no place for cowards, really. If you're afraid, then fear stinks. Fear stinks. So you pick it up really early. And I never really had that. I was really blessed that I could just go out there, and for some reason, I just switched on and I could just play and I could just express myself. So, yeah, it hurts when people obviously tell you that you, you're not going to do your dream job. But then when you do it at the end of the day, it feels kind of good to, because they know you did it. They know you did it.
Yeah, and I know you speak so highly about sort of your journey, Jack, and in terms of Danny Vermeulen, who obviously give you that chance to train with the task squad, if I'm right in saying, in 2004. I mean, how important is that moment in sort of your progress? Because did it kind of give you a platform to sort of build on and think, right, this is where I can now take the steps forward that I need to achieve my dream?
Yeah, massively. You know, Danny was the first guy who put his faith in me. I think that's what I always wanted, is somebody to believe in me. And Danny was, he was in a wheelchair. He couldn't move around in the pitch. You know, he was in his sat in his wheelchair, and he would coach from angles, and we would do our thing. But he was always there, and he was up early mornings. He was there late evenings. And again, it wasn't a financial thing. He didn't get paid for it. But, you know, the belief, again, it's the same thing I experienced when I joined Saracens, and Brendan Venter, Paul Gustard, all of them, Mark McCall. I came there, and I was relatively unknown. I was not a lot of people knew who I was, which is fine, you know. I just wanted an opportunity, and I mean, they could see that I was willing to work hard, you know, and do what I needed to do. And that belief when somebody really believes in you and they say, listen, you can do this, and you know that they really believe it, makes a massive difference to how you play, you know. I think we all doubt ourselves sometimes, especially in rugby and big state, big matches. And we go through stages where we're not playing that well, and sometimes it's going really well, you know. And then if you have that belief from somebody who backs you on the outside, coaches, especially teammates, it's very valuable.
Yeah, you mentioned there, obviously, moving to Saracens as well, Jack, and it comes off the back of kind of a mixed sort of period, if that's a fair assessment, when you were over in South Africa with the Bulls. So, as you said there, you came over as a relative unknown. So, was that kind of a fresh and exciting challenge for you to be moving to England and sort of want to try and make a mark, because you had the guys that you mentioned there who had that belief in your ability?
Yeah, I was ready. I was really ready. I played the Griquas for 3 years. Never really got my opportunity playing there, but I know why. I wasn't ready yet. You know, I was a 89-kilogram, 90-kilogram back rower who was chasing around everything. I was so wild. Made a lot of mistakes. I wasn't well coached. I was just wild. And then I learned a lot. You know, I went to France for a season, second division club, which was, you know, it's second division France. It was pretty much everybody does what they wanted to do at trainings and at and game day. So it was, again, wild, which suited me probably well. And then when I went to the Bulls, it was a lot more structured. But the main frustrating thing for me with the Bulls was they had a really settled squad. They had for a long time. Guys who were together from after school, straight after school. They've had a really strong squad full of Springboks, international players. And I was just on the outskirts, you know. I wasn't really let into their system, and I wasn't really given the opportunity and the belief wasn't really put in me to make a difference there, you know. But I was physically, for me, that was when I got strong and I worked hard, and I was physically ready, you know. I was ready to take on my next challenge. Wherever I went next, I knew that, I mean, I had to get my opportunity, and if I do get it, I'll use it. So, and luckily, you know, as it turns out, I went to Saracens, which was home for me. You know, when I joined them, I knew this is where I should be. And yeah, I just found my place there, and I was enjoyed my time extremely much over there.
Yeah, I think myself, Mark and Rob will be very glad you decided to make the move to England, Jack, so we could see you playing in the Premiership.
Thank
you. Right, and saying Japan was possible, a possible option as well as Saracen. So what was the kind of the main sort of selling point to you that, that ticked you over the edge to say, yeah, I'm going to go to Saracens instead of moving to Asia?
You know what, I when I left the Bulls, or when my contract expired at the Bulls, I haven't really won anything major, no major trophies or tournaments. And I was frustrated, you know. I wanted to go out. I decided, listen, I'm going to go out for myself and I'm going to go and play somewhere where I can make enough money to come back and settle and start my own thing. And yeah, Japan sounded like a great opportunity again. I mean, the culture, I think, for one, was one thing that drawn me towards Japan. And and there was decent money for that time, you know. And yeah, Edward Griffith called me. And he's a very persuasive man. And Brendan Venter called me, and he's an even more persuasive man. So the main message was kind of just like, they couldn't offer me what I was offered in Japan. But they just said, I'm not done yet. You know, I'm not done with my story yet. I need to still play. At that time, Japanese rugby was still relatively, it was still growing. You know, there wasn't any... There wasn't many big stars playing out there. So they just said, listen, there's so much more for you to do still in the UK and in Europe, you know, win cups, you know, there's big trophies that you can be involved in. And they just sold it to me, you know. And again, that was my first choice. But when I did go, you know, I was so glad. I was so glad I made that choice. You know, there's just a... You know, my old experience in England was really good. You know, I have so much respect for the English supporters as well. It's a completely different vibe. You know, they respect you a lot for what you do. That's my feeling. For if it's a bad day at the office, you wouldn't find people walking past and tell you, mate, you were terrible today. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, it's your job, you know, and you work bloody hard to try and do it well. So my whole experience in England, you know, playing there, the whole culture, the people, and England itself, and it was just the right move for me and the right place to be. So yeah, I was extremely blessed to be part of that group.
Just on the Saracens stuff, I was watching the 2011 Premiership Rugby Final highlights this afternoon before we jumped onto this podcast, and Saracens' defence during that, you know, the final stages of that game was quite incredible, and you were right at the thick of that. Just how special was that win for you after keeping Leicester out for so long? And do you think that good defence wins titles?
Oh, yeah, I'm all about defence. You know, you don't have to give me the ball. I would defend the whole game. I enjoy that the most out of everything in rugby. All the things people hate, mauling, rucking. I love that. I love that that battle there. But yeah. 2011 was very special. You know, the year before, as you know, we lost to Leicester just right to the end. And it was such a great journey up to that final. And when we lost that final, it was a bit heartbreaking. Heartbreaking to come so far and not get that win. And that next season, I know Brendan told us, he said, listen, it's not your time yet. It's not your time. So we'll keep on working next year. And when we did get to that final and the way it ended, you know, Leicester being on our line, and we could see both teams were knackered. You know, they didn't really try and move it out wide or do anything special. It was just bashing it up front. And it was a great feeling when that final whistle blew. I can remember who was the referee? Wayne Barnes was referee. I was every breakdown that last 10 minutes. I was screaming, holding, and trying to get him. And he was like, shut up. He was so frustrated. I just wanted to get it over with and go off and have a beer. But it was an incredible feeling. Incredible feeling.
I was just listening to you there saying, I love defense, I love rucking, I love mauling, and all of that sort of stuff. And I was just thinking of the back three players in that Saracens team during training. Every week, they must have hated it playing against you.
Yeah. I don't think they enjoyed it that much, but they were just too happy. They didn't have to. I remember Tulagi on the wing. I think the boys weren't too keen to get stuck into him. He was a big boy. He was angry. So they were just happy the boys were bashing it out in the front. They could stand out there, and they were pretty fresh after, I reckon.
And you mentioned as well, Jack, there, obviously, the heartache of 2010, and you go and redeem yourselves, if you like, in 2011. And it's obviously a great personal season. as well for you, and thinking, right, saying you were voted player of the year for the club. So, yeah. You know, that must have been so pleasing for you to obviously win, obviously, the team, and everyone says the team comes first, but a personal accolade for you in such a short space of time in England, that must have been very pleasing as well.
Yeah, it's not something you play for, really. I think no player would tell you that's something that's their aim, to be player of the year. And to be voted by the players, I mean, that makes it special. The players around you, they see every day what you do, and they know you as a person, personally, and they know the amount of work and effort you put in. So it was very special. You know, I remember that time well. I mean, it felt like this. I was on top of the world. Everything was going swiftly. Everything was going so well. Nothing could stop me. And then straight after that, out for 2 years. So that's how it works, unfortunately. But yeah, it was an incredible year.
Yeah, I was going to mention the injury, unfortunately, Jack. But just before we get onto that, you mentioned kind of the teammates and how great it was for you to be voted by your fellow peers to win player of the season. And when we do our preparations for the podcast, Rob was saying to me that on your Instagram, you do have sort of trips away when you're with the boys in Miami and all that team bonding kind of aspect. So how much does that remain so close to you and you remember so fondly? Because a lot of people will just see the 80 minutes of the team, what a team can do, but I guess the culture and the family aspect of it as well is probably more important, if you like.
Yeah, I was guilty of that as well early on when I joined. I was very rugby driven. I didn't go out during the weeks or weekends. I would get back home and rest. I had a goal, which isn't a bad thing, you know. It's a good thing. I wanted to be good. I wanted to be the best that I could be, and I remember all the boys and Edward Griffith as well. They kept hammering about spending time with each other, you know, going places, going on trips. And sometimes, you know, we would go a day before, 2 days before we play a major or big game, or a week before we would go on a massive binge. And at first I thought, just how can this be good? But then you realize, I mean, when you go away or go and you have a few beers and you're in a different place, different environment, and all the guys are together, you know, you don't talk rugby. When you find yourself, you're sitting next to a guy that you never spend time with, who's in a different locker room to you in training weeks, and you make a connection there. And I think that's what it's about. You know, if you care about each other on a rugby pitch, you'll work harder for the team, for the players. And it's, you know, everybody says it, you know, but we really believe that. You know, we spend a lot of time, and when we partied hard, like everybody does, but when it was time for training the next morning and you made sure you were there for 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock, whenever training starts, there was no bailing. You were part of this group or you weren't. You know, we work hard, and then when we do trips and stuff, we enjoy it as much as we can. And for us, again, it was about making memories, you know, because sitting here now, rugby is done. You know, there's nothing more I can do on a rugby pitch I mean, as much as I would love it, but now the memories of what you've done off the pitch and what you've done on the pitch, you know, these are all things that sticks by you, especially when you're done and it's all finished up and you're sitting back and you remember all those good times, then it's well worth it. Then it's well worth every break, every injury, every low. It's worth it, you know, because the highs and the good times are extremely good.
When I watched Saracens over the last decade, probably, and you know, they're quite well known for grinding things out. You've just sort of connected a few dots for me personally, that they seem to have that innate ability, like great sporting teams do. They would hang on in when they weren't playing very well and win it in the last 15 minutes, possibly because they looked around and they knew each other, which other teams didn't seem to have.
No, definitely. We knew we can get out of any situation just because we trusted each other. Now we spend so much time together. We know what everybody is capable of, you know. And we had a pact, you know. If you're not willing to work hard enough, you know, then you know, can't be part of this group. You can't be part of the nice trips. You go away, and it was all about, you know, it's about work ethic. You know, it's about intensity. It's about taking teams to play. places where they feel extremely uncomfortable. You know, we, if you take in the UFC, they talk about taking people to the deep water, you know, taking them to that dark place, that tough place where some people are not willing to go, you know, and we were willing to go there as hard as it was and as tough as it was. And we focused a lot on things that people didn't see, you know, the how quick you get off the ground, how hard you chase kicks, all those things you were rewarded for, the things that other people saw as just, it has to happen. You know, we paid a lot of attention to those things, you know, is to put teams under so much pressure that they eventually fold, you know, it's give and take, you know, sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes teams deal well with it, you know, but we were always up for it.
Yeah. It was a seems to be a group of guys who were playing individually at the top of the game, but collectively were another 10% better than that.
Yeah. It was, I mean, I remember some really tough games, you know, and I never felt like if we were 20 points down with 10 minutes to go, I always felt there was a chance that we could make it. You know, there's a chance we can get back into this and the main thing, you know, the main thing when you lose, you do lose, and sometimes it doesn't go as you planned, you know. But you know, I talk about Brendan a lot. Somebody I have a lot of respect for in that sense. He would, after a game we would lose, and I would sit and I would be not devastated, but I'd be in a bad place, and I would sit and Brendan would come up to me and he said, "Brilliant game today." And I think myself, what do you mean? And he said, "No, I saw how you got up there and how you chased that kick. Incredible. That was, loved your work rate." And he just kept putting that fire in you, and you were ready for it, you know, ready for next week. You're like, "Yeah, okay, let's take this one on the chin. Next week, we'll get stuck in." And, you know, it was just feeding that positive information. You know, he always said, there's two types of errors. You know, there's a skill error and there's an effort error, you know, and there's skill errors we all make constantly. But I mean, if there's a problem with your effort, and then you have to dig deep, and then you have to ask a couple of questions to yourself. So, if he saw that it wasn't an effort error, then he was happy with what you put in.
And that collectiveness as well, Jack, is that something that was massively important for you when you did have that long injury you mentioned before? Because we talked at the top of the podcast about how difficult injuries are for players. But for you, you'd obviously just come off the high of winning the Premiership, and you do go on to make more memories with the team in 2015. But that must have been such a difficult moment for you to be laid off for that amount of time.
Yeah, it's tough. It doesn't matter how good the team environment is and how much people ask you, "How are you going? Are you getting better?" Because I was getting asked that every day by every player. "You're getting better?" And I promise you, a lot of them didn't think I was going to get back, because it wasn't looking good for a long time, you know. So it's, but you do feel lost. You feel you're out of the group for some reason. You're just not there where they are. It's not because they're not making the effort to chat to you and to ask how you're doing and to support you, and you go out to them, but just because you're not out on the pitch, you're not in that team environment, you're not in that match day locker room, you're not there with the big losses and the big wins, you know, the disappointments and the glory. I mean, you're not sharing that with them. That's what you miss, you know. That's when the injuries hit you hard, when you're sitting at home or at a pitch and you see the boys are digging in, you know, and win or lose, you want to be in that locker room after, because you know, yes, we together gave our everything today. So, I mean, that's the thing you miss when you're injured, because you want to be involved in that group and stuff. You just for some reason you just feel you're not part of that group anymore. I don't know. It is not like that. I know a lot of players, like I said, supported me extremely well, and everybody, the club, did everything they could to get me back on the pitch. But you just feel you're a little bit on the outskirts.
Yeah, and sort of that collectiveness again, Jack, is something that we hear a lot about Saracens. I mean, we had Alex Lewington, who's a current Saracens player, obviously, on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and we did ask him the question about what the club had been through sort of over the last 7 to 8 months or so, because back here it has been the story, and probably arguably in world rugby as well, what's happened with Saracens and sort of the salary cap breaches and relegation. But from your point of view, I mean, what did you make of the story when it first unfolded?
Yeah, I was disappointed. I was, because I knew a lot of players, support just didn't like Saracens, you know, for whatever reason. And for me, I thought about the players instantly, and the supporters, you know, they people who didn't have anything to do with any salaries or the payments or whatever the case may be, you know. And I don't exactly know what happened. I still don't know. You know, I know somewhere too much money was spent. But I'm pretty sure there's a lot of other clubs that are not far off, you know. I don't think it's something that's that uncommon. So, I mean, the thing that frustrates me the most is that I don't know what anybody got salary-wise, you know. And I promise you, I wasn't the highest paid player in the Premiership by far. But, you know, all I wanted to do is go out and play, you know, and I wanted to do it for Saracens. I believed in the club, and they were unbelievably good to me. You know, they were so good to me, and they supported my family really well. And to the bad times and the good times, they were always there. You know, and I saw the time they put in, I saw the work, and I believed in what they were doing. I still do, you know, away from the money, away from what anybody received cash-wise. At the end of the day, when there was 23 guys on the pitch, you know, I wouldn't want to be with any other 22 players on that pitch. I wanted to be with those guys because I knew that they would be there, you know, and that was a club culture. It's you can't buy those things, you know. It's not something you put money, throw money at, and then it develops, you know. You can buy the best players in the world, and it's not going to make a great team. You know, we came together without, I mean, a lot of unknown players, relatively unknown players. If you look at the names from the 2009-2010 season, a lot of guys who came together and just kind of fit and folded in and became part of this family. But, you know, the reality of it is it did damage the image of Saracens, unfortunately. And then a lot of people look at it and say, "No, listen, those years, you know, they paid too much money for this, and they cheat. And for me, you know, it's you go out on the pitch and it's 23 guys, you play the other 23 guys, and the team who wins walks away with a cup. So, I mean, that's how it works.
And you're obviously talking there, Jack, from a player perspective, and you mentioned sort of your old teammates there at the start of that answer. So did you have sort of sympathy with Owen and Brad and Richard, etc., that they were kind of being, everyone's pointing the finger at them, but as you say, they were probably just going out there, giving it their all for 80 minutes to try and get the job done for Saracens and the fans?
Yeah, I don't think these players were aware of anything, any breach of salaries, or I don't know. I mean, I don't know. They would know themselves. I mean, I know. Again, I have a lot of respect for them, so I wouldn't believe that they would get involved in something that they knew was wrong or was against the laws, you know. And a lot of these players are world-class players that came through the academy, you know. Saracens Academy, it's not about how much they were paid. It's they were developed into world-class players. They're worth a lot, you know. They're worth a lot somewhere else. So if you can't, if you bring them through your academy, you want to keep your players. If you look at Mary Toje, George Crew, he's leaving the club now. A lot of players leaving the club now because obviously of the championship thing. But I mean, Owen, look, you name them. They're world class players who make a difference in any team, you know. And they came through the academy system, and they stuck. You know, and the club looked after them. And I mean, at the end of the day, too much, maybe, you know. They obviously breached the salary cap, which is there for a reason. The rules should be followed. That I agree with that 100%. But for me, from a player aspect and from a teammate and friend, I don't believe that they that money was their main driving point. That the thing that made them perform the way they do wasn't money. You know, they were probably getting paid well for what they were doing, but they were out there to do their best for the team and for the club.
And you mentioned kind of the academy players, that they're all adored by sort of the supporters at Allianz Park. So for you to sort of get the reception you did when you ran out on that final game of the season with your family, that must have been a very special moment, because you said before, you know, it was, you felt like you were home as soon as you got there. So to finish up with that reception must have been very special for you.
Yeah, it was bittersweet. It was bittersweet. I actually hurt my knee for the last time. I think that's when I knew. We had an event that week, the week before the match, or 2 weeks before that, it was Newcastle, that final game. And we did a mauling session, and I was frustrated because, again, like I told you previously, I wasn't playing well. I was aching, I was sore, and it was a mauling session, and mauling sessions can be quite, can get quite heated. So I got stuck in, and then the next day I woke up and my knee was massive. It was, and I knew like this was probably it. Like, I'm not going to come back from this because I wasn't playing well. There was no time for me to get myself back in the team, maybe to play finals or whatever. Will Frazier was playing extremely well. So he was, I knew then. And then I went to Smalley actually, and I said to him, listen, I'm done. I think this is me. There's just one too many now. Is there a way that I can play one more game? And is there a way that I can maybe play another home game or whatever? And they didn't hesitate. They said, yeah, sure. Man, I wasn't ready. I wasn't training. I don't think I was training that week. I was just trying to get that knee down as far as possible, get the swelling down, and try to see if I can get back on the limp and start and play that last game. And last game, I wasn't special again. I didn't play really well, but the reception I got afterwards, you know, it was amazing. You know, it's sad in a way as well, because you know, you're not going to do that ever again. You're not going to play the game of rugby. You don't know how to feel. You're a bit unsure, and to say goodbye there, and all the other guys are carrying on with their rugby careers, and you step away. It's tough, you know. But it was great that I could do it in front of my supporters, and with the club that I love and the club that supported me so much through my career. So extremely blessed to have finished my career there.
And I know we've talked quite a lot about injuries, Jack, but you did manage to fit in three World Cups for your country, enjoying your career. I mean, I think if I'm right in saying you were captain at two of the tournaments as well. So what was that special moment like? Because I've seen someone ask you the question, oh, did you want to play for South Africa? You immediately shut them down and said, absolutely not. There was only one country I was ever going to play for.
Definitely. And if I even got that in England as well, and I was playing there for a while, people would say, you probably got it that you played for Namibia. And I would ask them, why? I'm Namibian. You know, I grew up here. This is the country I love. Yes, we're a small nation, a small rugby nation. And the big difference is when I stand out there and I sing my national anthem, I mean, there's a lot of people that I know personally that's watching it. It's not just supporters. You know, it's family, it's friends, it's people who know who you are. You know, and I love my country. Yes, we have our problems, and there's a lot of issues with Namibian rugby. But for me to put on that Namibian shirt and represent Namibia as a whole, and stand there and sing the anthem, and to go out there and play for my country, it's. I'm Namibian again. I mean, that's where I want to be. That's where who I want to play for. You know, it doesn't matter how much you get paid. You know, I don't judge anybody moving to another country and playing for another country. I mean, if you get the opportunity, of course. But I mean, for me, it was just, I wanted to be a Namibian rugby player. And playing for Namibia, no, I've had some really special memories. You know, we've had some big hidings. There's been some times where it's been dark. But I mean, it's been special. We've made some great memories, and I mean, the Namibian players. The one thing I can say about Namibian people is how modest they are, and I really enjoy that about them. I mean, too modest sometimes. Trying to get them fired up and be a little bit more dog sometimes. But they're great people. You know, they're very humble and very coachable, and yeah, I enjoyed my time with Namibia extremely much, and I'm. To play in three World Cups for my country and to captain them in two is what an honour.
We talked to quite a few players, obviously, this rugby pod hosted by Chris. One of the players that struck a chord with me was Jonathan Davis, the ex-Rugby League, Rugby Union international. For me, it's a crying shame that Jonathan Davis isn't involved in coaching or mentoring anymore. He's commentating on the BBC. Just spending 45 minutes talking to you, Jack, it's a crying shame that you're not leading that charge to make Namibia great. Because if you say it's Tuesday, it's probably Tuesday.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the first couple of years after rugby, it was always, I always decided I was going to get my business. I bought the farm about 6 years ago, and there's a lot that needed to be done here to get my life, to get finances, you know, to get money, to do stuff, to have food on the table, you know, you need to work. So I had to take time to do that. I mean, but after that, it's just, it's not a very desirable place to work at the moment, the Namibian Rugby Union. There's not enough people who want to grow the game. There's not enough people who are selfless and want to see Namibian rugby being a top 15 of the world, you know, winning a game with the World Cup. You know, everybody wants it, but nobody wants to do the work to get there. So, I mean, I said this earlier, I don't want to get involved with selfless people. You know, I don't want to work with people who don't want to grow the game, who don't want to see Namibia do well on the world stage. Because I truly believe, you know, we're not a lot of players, but we have a lot of talent. We have a lot of good people with good values, you know, hardworking people. So I do want to get involved in rugby again. I don't know how. I don't know. I've not been contacted by anybody from the NOU. It's not a very loving relationship, you know, which I'm not shy about. You know, I've been a bit outspoken. You know, I've played for Namibia for a long time. You know, and some of the stories I can tell you, the hairs will stand in the back of your neck. You know, there's been some horrific things going on. And I'm just afraid that we'll never play in the World Cup again. You know, honestly, there's not enough going on, to be honest. World Rugby, I don't think they've got too much patience left with us. They've been giving us finances and trying to boost us, helping us with world-class coaches. And every time we just give them the middle finger. I don't want to be part of that. You know, it's unfortunate that that's the way it is. But I do want to get involved in rugby again. So let's see where it goes. And hopefully in the future, I can with a team that wants to grow Namibian rugby and wants to see us succeed and do well and win games of the World Cup and play in big tournaments. I mean, that's where I want to be, you know. And I want to be with a team who's selfless and want to see Namibian rugby succeed instead of having a free trip and telling your mates you're a big dog in Namibian rugby. That's basically the problem that's there right now. So we'll see how it pans out. But I'm not extremely positive about Namibian rugby at the moment, just because I don't feel enough's being done to grow the game here. Not enough's being done to try and get Namibian into proper tournaments. You know, trying to get them bigger test matches. And I know World Rugby, also has a big part to play in that. But we have to do our bit as well before we can expect anything from somebody else. So, that's the frustrating thing at the moment in Namibian rugby. And then we'll see how it works. Hopefully, we can get to a place where we have the right people there who want to see Namibian rugby succeed.
I have a sneaking, well, more than a sneaking suspicion that if Jack Burgard is involved, then it will be right.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. You know, I love the game, and I love Namibian rugby. So, and I do see the talent. So, I do want to get back in, but I mean, I need the right support, you know, and I need to find my right role. You know, I can't step in as a head coach right now. You know, I'm 350 kilometers away from the city. You know, it's I can't be there every day. You know, 700 kilometers a day is a bit much to commute. So there's a lot of things that need to fall in place, you know. But I do have time to consulting manner, you know, to go in every now and again and to see how things goes and to help put plans together and see how we can develop. And there's a lot that I can do, but there's not enough people asking me and wanting me involved because I say too much.
I just wanted to ask you one thing, Jack, if you don't mind, about sort of what you've mentioned there, because on Talking Rugby Union, we did a couple of interviews with Phil Davis during the World Cup, and he seemed like a man who brought a lot of professionalism to your country and your team. But as you said there, you put it very nicely, that people are giving the middle finger to these coaches. So was that quite frustrating for you to see during the 2019 World Cup, where you were hoping Phil and that professionalism was going to help your country take the next step, if you like?
Yeah, massively. I was very disappointed that Phil left, you know. But it wasn't easy for him. You know, if you you can sit down with Phil and ask him personally, if he's willing to speak about everything that's happening in the Namibian rugby, I'm sure you'll understand why he's not here right now. But yeah, I've got a lot of respect for Phil, you know. Welshmen, you know, Welsh people are nice people. I don't know why. They're always friendly. Maybe because they like having a beer every now and again. But he was a great guy. I mean, that's the main thing. He was a great bloke and a great person. And yes, we disagreed on a lot of things, but it was never a fight, you know. And he knew when to put his foot down, and everybody looked up to him. You know, everybody wanted to follow him, and he had great ideas. He's grew up in a professional setup. You know, it's everything we needed. But yeah, I think it was just too tough for Phil. They just made it impossible for him to stick around.
Well, we do hope, as Mark says there, that you are involved, Jack, with the union moving forward, because you'll be I'm sure a very good addition if that ever comes to pass. But we're gonna probably finish by talking a little bit more about your playing career, if you don't mind, Jack. And before we go on to Mars 15, which has become a real highlight of these podcasts, I saw you tweet, I think it was either towards the start of this year or a few months ago, that one player that you would have loved to play against was Jonah Lomu.
Yeah, what a legend. What a legend. Yeah, I mean, who doesn't want to play against Jonah Lomu? You know, I remember ninth. Yeah. There's probably a lot who don't. I mean, it's just must be the ultimate challenge, I think, as a defender, having big Jonah running at you at full pace. You know, he's probably not going to try to run over you. You think you're going to sit there and wait for him. He's probably going to beat you on the outside, you're not even going to touch him. But I mean, just that challenge of you versus Jonah Lomu in a 5-meter channel, that excites me, you know. And I know you can, there's a good possibility you might wake up and you ask your friends what just happened. But I mean, what an honor that would have been.
Well, I'm hopefully going to try and predict your team, Jack, and say Jonah might be in your Mars 15, but normally Mars hosts. He's in. He's given us a sneak insight before we run through your team. So, Mark, over to you for this.
Well, I think this 15 will be absolutely in your image, Jack, I think. And I'm really looking forward to it. Here's the premise for anybody listening out there. That the Martians have landed. They've challenged Earth to a game of rugby to decide the future of civilization. It's a game we're not prepared to lose. On Saturday, the shuttle leaves, takes 4 weeks to get to Mars. And it's any era, any code, any player. It's a game we've got to win. So it's 15 players, a coach, a manager, a kit man, and a water boy. Over to you.
Okay, I've got him here. You're probably going to think I'm pretty boring with this, but if I'm going to Mars, they seem like they could be a tough bunch. So you need to pick big. You need to take a solid team over. So I started loose head prop. I started with Austin Wright. Obviously a beast of a human being. I remember playing him in, it was in 2007 when they beat us by 100 points. You know, I've never seen a guy that strong destroyed us. Hooker, Scott Brits. I mean, world class, you know. He can do anything. He's just a freak, you know. He annoys me. That's how good he is. And then I decided to go with Marcos Ayerza from Argentina as a tight end. Basically, very good rugby player, but you have to have an Argentinian in your team. They are the nicest people ever, you know. I've not met an Argentinian player who's not a really, really nice guy. So he has to be there. I don't know him at all, but I'm sure he's a good guy. And then Bucky's Bertha on four, my number four lock. I'm sure he won't back down. and then my number five, I decided to go for Dodie Weir.
Oh, turning
50 this week.
Yeah, brilliant.
So I decided I would love to have him and my team representing Earth. And celebrating his 50th, you know, would be pretty good as well.
Quality.
And then Ruben Kruger was one of the players that I followed when I was a youngster. I have a lot of respect for him and the way he played. You know, wasn't somebody who scored great tries. Just again, another hard worker. Can you guys hear me still?
Yep.
Okay, good. I lost the picture there. Zoom doesn't work that well in Namibia. and then Richie McCaw, for obvious reasons. What a legend of the game. You know, it's growing up, again, a player I wanted to spend some time with on a rugby pitch, probably against against each other would have been better, just to see what he's all about. And then at number eight, you have to have a Frenchman there, and L'Animal, Sebastian Chabal. He's the guy you got to have there when the Martians get a little bit upset and you need to sort things out. I'm sure he's there. My number nine, Neil de Kock. Again, a great rugby brain, but one of the nicest guys in the world. All the girls, the Saracens used to say, all the women used to say, the wives and the girlfriends, that not everybody has a Neil de Kock. You know, everybody wanted to be married to Neil de Kock. He's the nicest guy in the world. Dan Carter, 10. And then Big Jonah, 11. And our game plan was obviously just to get the ball to Big Jonah all the time. then I had number 12, Manny Tuilagi. Yeah. Number 13, Brian O'Driscoll. Yeah. My right wing, Rupeni Thauthau. And my fullback, Christian Cullen. That would be my starting lineup, my team playing. I can't really, obviously, I don't know a lot of them, but I mean, most rugby players are pretty decent guys. So when we do go out for a few beers afterwards, I'm pretty sure all these guys will be brilliant lads and we'll have a great time. And then for my manager, I went with Jürgen Klopp.
Brilliant. That's gone down well.
Very well. Very well.
No, to be honest, I'm not a big football supporter, but he's just a guy that, how can you not like him? It's just something about him that, that again, inspires you and can see why he's so successful. Coach, I went with Scott Robertson from the Crusaders. Looks like a decent, fun guy. And obviously, coach is one of the best teams, club teams in the world. And looks like he can have a good party with the boys afterwards as well. And then I put myself at Waterboy because I want to be involved in this team.
I thought you might.
Yeah. And I always wanted to hear what the coaches and the players and the vibe, what the coaches say about the players on the pitch. And just to be involved with the match really as well. That'll be great. And then my kit man would be Richard Barrington, Saracen's prop. Because everybody needs somebody to sing the song afterwards and have a good party, and he's always there.
Tell me, Jack, who's your captain?
My captain would be, I'm going to go somebody left field. Nah, let's go with Neil de Kock. You know, I'm going to go with Neil de Kock. Nice. The smallest guy on the pitch. He's got that number nine attitude, you know, like all number nines. You don't really know if they tough, but then they make you know that they are really tough and they might hurt you. So he's probably my captain. He'll sort things out for us.
I love it. I love it. I love that back row. I love the back
Thank
row.
You very much. Yeah, that is that's a pretty decent back row. I wouldn't mind being amongst one or two of those players, really, or three of them, all three of them, actually.
Brilliant, brilliant team, Jack. And just one more question before we before you let you go. Obviously, you've pitched your Mars 15 there and you're 15 to take on the Martians. But I was watching a video in preparation for our podcast and it was with a load of Saracens fans, I think, before one of the Premiership finals, and they were sort of picking their all-time Saracens team, and you were always in that team. So when you have time to kind of reflect on your career and you do hear those messages, and does that kind of put a smile on your face at all those mammoth efforts you put in finals and big games and all that blood, sweat and tears you've been through has been recognised so much by those Saracens supporters?
Oh yeah, I've been supported so well since I joined there. You know, I think I was, again, extremely blessed. You know, those guys have been supporting me so well from day one. And even now, I'm still getting support from them. And it's good to see that people appreciate what you've done for the team and for the club. You know, because I was truly a club guy. I was truly a team player. I wanted to do well, not just for me, but for the club and everybody around them. Everybody supported them. So I've got a lot of love for the supporters, the club, and everybody around. And yeah, I'd like to thank them obviously for the support they've given me and still giving me throughout these years.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Jack. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to catch up with you.
Thank you, guys.
And obviously speak about your brilliant career. So, Jack, thank you so much for giving us your time this afternoon.
It's a massive pleasure. Thank you very much, guys. Have a good evening.
So, many thanks to Jack Berger for his time there. That was a fantastic listen, wasn't it, guys?
That was unbelievable. Really.
Yeah. You can sense exactly that Saracens Wolfpack mentality. When you've got individuals like that, and you've got many of them, geez, no wonder they won more than they lost. And when they lost, they took it very, very personally.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it was brilliant chatting to Jack, and we're getting some fantastic guests on the podcast at the moment. So keep checking out what the Looseheads guys are doing. Rob, as Dave isn't here, I'm going to hand you over with the social media and the website.
Yeah, get yourself over to looseheads.co.uk to get yourself some Looseheads clothing. You can enter the code POD at checkout for 10% off.
Great stuff. And I know the Looseheads guys are planning something a bit exciting with a few of the ambassadors towards the end of this week. So please do keep your eyes out for that across the website and social media. Many thanks to Rob and Mark, as always. And that has been another Looseheads podcast in association with Talking Rugby Union.